From the Republican National Convention in San Diego, this is Democracy Now!
I became a Republican because I want to help fill the big tent that our party has raised to attract all Americans. You all know that I believe in a woman's right to choose, and I strongly support affirmative action. And I was invited here by my party to share my views with you because we are a big enough party and big enough people to disagree on individual issues and still work together for our common goal, restoring the American dream.
The New York Daily News calls it Powell to the People. Colin Powell addresses the GOP convention as the people are cordoned off outside. A look at the Koch Four, how Senator Dole and others tried to obstruct a Senate investigation into a Kansas oil company. And log cabin Republicans finish their convention. They explain why they want to be part of a party that wants no part of them.
One of our biggest concerns for the gay and lesbian community in general is that traditionally it has put all of its eggs in one basket and then it gets taken for granted by the Democratic Party and often demagogued or written off by the Republican Party. That is not a strategy for empowerment. We have to be in both parties. We can't afford, our issues are too important to have no voice in a Dole administration. So we have to operate, I think, and the goal of this is to operate in the best faith effort.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in San Diego, joined by my co-hosts Larry Bensky, National Affairs Correspondent for Pacifica, and Juan Gonzalez, a columnist for the New York Daily News. Well, it happened yesterday. The Republicans opened their 36th annual convention here, and last night the keynote speaker was, I don't know if he's officially called the keynote speaker,
no, that's Susan Molinari tonight.
Colin Powell was the main highlight last night, and he mentioned the forbidden word abortion. He also talked about his support for affirmative action.
Actually, he didn't mention the forbidden word abortion. We get to hear that when he talked about a woman's right to choose, which is not the same thing as the dread A word. And even in using that phrase, the women's right to choose and affirmative action, he drew boos from the floor, which was really quite surprising to many people watching the Love Fest and television show and infomercial that the first night of the convention had become.
Although I have to say, Larry, standing there on the floor of the convention as he was speaking, while the boos came in when he said, "I am pro-choice," it was then overwhelmed by applause from the floor and everyone standing up. In fact, I was standing next to two delegates. One stood up when he said, "I am pro-choice," and held up a sign and he said, which said, "Go away." And the a woman behind him told him to get out of the convention, that he had no place. So little skirmishes were breaking out on the floor.
That was the climactic moment of dissent in the convention, the lone moment of dissent. And it was only a passing reference.
You have to wonder, though, when you see something like that, Juan and Amy, what the reaction of this delegation would be and how infectious it might be if Powell indeed had been the vice presidential choice. You would be seeing a much different national political dynamic.
Right, and I think also that there would not maybe have been the politeness or the right to life movement toward him, because they knew that basically at this point the candidates had been chosen and Powell was basically providing a public relations or promotion perspective for the rest of the population.
Sure, they threatened to bolt if that were to happen. Well, we're going to get back to our discussion of General Colin Powell and what he had to say and who he is in just a minute. But before we do that, Juan, something too important happened yesterday for
Juan
us to move
lunch.
On.
Juan does lunch.
It was kind of amazing. I just returned from the border interviewing some people who were crossing over from into the United States when we stopped in Old Town for lunch at the Mexican cafe and cantina in Old Town. And no sooner had we sat down, and I was noticing all these Secret Service agents outside, and I figured, oh, some politician is here. But in walks Bob Dole to have lunch in the Mexican cafe and cantina. A few minutes later, as he's shaking hands and coming around to the various tables, including the one that I was sitting at, in walks Jack Kemp, and then the two wives of the candidates, and they all sit down a few tables away from us. And for it seemed like a perfect photo opportunity, given all of the criticism toward the Republican Party and its strong anti-immigrant platform, when all of a sudden the great photo opportunity is interrupted by a young woman who begins to shout out at the candidates.
I basically put him on the spot and said, Mr. Doe, you're a hypocrite for sitting and eating the food of the people whom you want out of this country, whom you code word as illegal aliens, when in reality you know what illegal alien is. Alien putting it a monstrous face to the Mexicano population or people coming from south to work the jobs, as the women who were making the tortillas that he was feeding his fat mouth with, you know? And that, in a sense, just slaps you in the face. He comes in your own, let's say, in your own house, you know, to eat your own food, and yet on national TV he scapegoats us, you know, him and his Republican agenda. The first time that I said anything, they didn't hear me, and the crowd didn't hear me because the musicos were just ending. And when I said it loud enough, he looked at me and he was pretty surprised. He didn't say anything, but his running mate Kemp looked at me and then hugged Bob Dole and said, oh, Bob Dole's your best friend, which is a bunch of bull, for lack of a better term.
Actually, Kemp said he's the best friend you'll ever have. But it was amazing how Dole was almost in total shock. But Kemp, now in his new role, not as quarterback but as blocking back, immediately rushed to his defense. Kemp spoke some Spanish to the crowd and attempted to defuse the situation.
How's his Spanish?
His Spanish is not bad. I have to say it's not bad. But attempted to defuse the situation and was clearly much more the diplomat than Dole was.
It's a good thing that Pacifica's Chuy Varela was with you and was able to chase that woman outside. She got ejected from the restaurant.
Right. The Secret Service immediately gathered around her and spirited her out of the restaurant. And amazingly, then the musicians who were there began to play La Cucaracha.
So, what did you talk with Dole and Kemp about, Juan?
Well, he was not talking to any reporters. He only wanted to talk to real people, and as such, refused any requests for any interviews.
I also heard Chuy was saying yesterday that they played Guantanamera.
Yes, that was Dole's request to the musicians.
Based on the words of Jose Marti.
It's a good thing there weren't any Cuban Americans in the restaurant. We might have really had a bunch up. So you wrote about this in your column in the New York Daily News today.
Yes, I did. And to me, the irony of them going to a Mexican restaurant precisely at the time when they've adopted the most anti-immigrant platform in the Republican Party, was not lost. And not only that, they didn't need to tip the musicians.
Oh, no.
The most interesting thing is I asked the musicians where they were from, and both of them are from Mexico. They commute over into the United States every day to work at that restaurant. But they didn't get any tips out of the event.
Meanwhile, I still think it's funny to see Dole and Kemp together as friends, as partners, as running mates. Since in 1985, I was remembering this joke that was written up in Senator for Sale, the unauthorized biography of Senator Dole. Kemp said, in a recent fire, Bob Dole's library burned down, both books were lost, and he hadn't even finished coloring one of them yet.
Oh, no, he's...
That's Jack Kemp in 1985. Were they joking around at the lunch? Did he share the joke again?
Not that one, no.
You didn't see any coloring books either.
No.
Well, meanwhile, while you were there at lunch talking with Dole and Kemp, I was over at the Freedom of Speech Pen, I guess we can call it, which is the pen somewhat near the convention, which from where you actually can't hear much of what's being said or chanted or yelled. And that's where all of the protests are taking place. There are some on the streets, but when it comes to the convention, they can't come any closer than behind two railroad tracks and a lot of mesh fences. Well, there was a massive demonstration against CCRI, the California Civil Rights Initiative, and also against the whole immigrant stance of the Republican Party. I'd say more than 1,000 people were there, a lot of black and brown faces, and also a lot of white women, because there were organizations like the National Organization for Women. Patricia Ireland spoke. Eleanor Smeal spoke from the feminist majority. There's a real coalition that's been organized. And in addition to that, there was another interesting protest there. It was the protest of tobacco money in the Republican Party. In fact, in the Republican and Democratic Party. And they were focusing on Philip Morris. Now, we got little party bags when we came to this convention, all of us reporters, and in it is the Kraft Convention Edition of macaroni and cheese that we're supposed to take home with us. Well, Kraft is owned by Philip Morris, and they were saying, don't eat Kraft, don't smoke Philip Morris cigarettes, of course, for other reasons than supporting the company.
Yeah, too late. I already threw my macaroni and cheese away.
Morton Downey Jr. was there, long a proponent of smoking on the board of the National Smokers Alliance. He's turned around because he has lung cancer now and just had part of his lung removed 3 weeks ago. He spoke. And also a bunch of other people were speaking from the American Lung Association, the American Cancer Association. And last night there was a party of the Georgia delegation at the Museum of Art. No, I don't think Newt Gingrich was there, but there were a bunch of angry protesters there that Philip Morris could rent out a public facility like the Museum of Art, especially since the Museum of Art promised them this wouldn't happen, and fed the Georgia delegation. One of the people standing outside, along with a number of butt men that we've seen around, was Ed Gillette, a man who has emphysema.
I started smoking in 1941. There was no evidence of it being harmful. And then they've been lying for the last 20 years about its addiction and about the fact that it does kill people. They lied before the Senate. Yes, I smoked. I'm not blaming the tobacco company. Now I'm blaming them for trying to own the politicians and to try to formulate the rules and the laws, like this thing here. It's in Balboa Park, the public park, and it's sponsored by and paid for by Philip Morris. And why are they entertaining all these delegates? Because they want to buy their votes. And they might just do that, too. Been doing it.
And that's Ed Gillette standing outside the Museum of Art protesting the Georgia delegation being feted by Philip Morris on public property. They weren't able to come near the museum. Even the sidewalks were cordoned off. And he couldn't protest, actually. He couldn't chant because he has emphysema. He would clap as everyone else was shouting.
And Einstein, you had your own problems over there?
That's right. Actually, they wouldn't let you light up? We'll be talking about... Well, interesting you should say that, Larry, because the Georgia delegation, a number of them, came out midway through the party, and they all lit up, blowing smoke at the protesters. That was pretty interesting. Yes, I went to talk with the Museum of Art about why they were giving their property over to Philip Morris Company, and they called the police over, who picked me up and threw me off the sidewalk. I must say, it was a bit of a relief, because once they picked me up, the weight off my feet after 15 hours of standing, I almost asked them to carry me home.
But you know, the Republican convention, for that matter, the Democratic convention, are really no different from, let's say, the Olympic Games. I mean, these events are heavily sponsored by private corporate interests who are here, obviously, to get access to the politicians. It's been going on for years. It's an ongoing scandal. They were supposed to be, the conventions were publicly funded after the reforms in the mid-1970s, and they aren't. ITT had a major scandal back in the early 70s, funding the Republican convention here in San Diego, or trying to, and that led to these supposed reform laws, which don't reform anything. I mean, if you go to, I haven't had the, shall we say, desire, or actually even the strength to try to go to any of these ridiculous parties with Republicans after the convention is over at night, but I've been to them in previous years, and they're always corporate sponsored, and they're always sponsored by corporations with heavy interest before the very people that they are hosting at their parties.
Larry, even the bands that we wear for the press that we have, when we have our press credentials around our neck, are United Airlines
That's
bands.
Right. You know what?
So we're all walking advertisements for United Airlines.
I've been trying to ink it out, but I keep getting ink all over my neck when I do that.
Well, nothing says that you can't buy yourself your own white shoelace and replace the United Airlines thing. And give us, no, it's all a question of corporate sponsorship. It's a story that doesn't get covered, of course, in the establishment media, which themselves sponsor part of this. I mean, the media party the other night was sponsored by the extreme right-wing owners of the San Diego Union-Tribune, the Copley newspapers. So this goes on and on and on, and it's part of the bought and sold nature, which this program has talked about repeatedly over the months, of the American political system.
Well, I have to say, last night I thought there was quite an irony. We were talking about Guantanamera being played as Jack Kemp and Bob Dole were eating their Mexican lunch yesterday. Well, when the protesters were chanting, it bothered Philip Morris and the Georgian delegation and the Museum of Art so much, particularly, I would say, the Museum of Art, who had their representatives there. They brought out the mariachi band outside so that they would drown out the protesters. And every time they chanted, they played. What did they play? Love Story. What is Love Story about? A young woman who died of cancer.
Died of cancer, right. Meanwhile, back at the convention center, we had what every newspaper in the United States and every television station is leading with today, the love feast between Colin Powell and the Republican Party. And I must say, Juan and Amy, that whoever wrote his speech or whatever role he wrote in himself, it was a very, I think, effective delivery, a very well crafted speech. As far as the contents of it, that's something we can talk about right now, but the delivery and the drama of it are exactly what the Republicans wanted.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we're going to hear a few excerpts of that speech last night of General Colin Powell.
The Republican Party The Republican Party must always be the party of inclusion. The Hispanic immigrant who became a citizen yesterday must be as precious to us as a Mayflower descendant. The descendant of a slave or of a struggling minor in Appalachia must be as welcome and must find as much appeal in our party as in any other party or any other American might. It is our diversity that has made us strong. Yet our diversity has sadly, throughout our history, also been the source of discrimination. Discrimination that we, as guardians of the American dream, must rip out branch and root. It is our party. It is our party, the party of Lincoln, that must always stand for equal rights and fair opportunity for all. And where discrimination still exists, or where the scars of past discrimination still contaminate and disfigure the present, we must not close our eyes to it, declare there is a level playing field, and hope that it will go away by itself. It did not in the past. It will not in the future. Let the party of Lincoln be in the forefront, leading the crusade, not only to cut off and kill discrimination, but to open every avenue of educational and economic opportunity to those who are still denied access because of their race, ethnic background, or gender.
That's a pretty strong plea, Juan, for affirmative action, isn't it?
Well, there's no doubt that I think the strongest parts of his speech were just precisely the section that we played here, where he clearly said, look, we still got a problem in this country. And we should not be attempting to paper it over that racism and discrimination still exists. And I think, generally speaking, the Powell speech was a very strong delivery, and it was almost as if the Republican delegates there, knowing full well what their platform has put forth to the American people, saw in the ability of Powell to forget that platform, in essence, and to concentrate on this grander vision of the United States that, let's say, Ronald Reagan would be apt to have given them in the past, were delighted. Oh, it was. They were clapping almost before he finished every phrase or sentence in the speech. And I think that, but what struck me most is how Powell constantly referred to the need and the ability of the Republican Party to maintain a strong military. He referred to it time and again that's one of the things that has attracted him to the Republican Party as a soldier, the ability of the party always to put the interest of maintaining a strong and effective military for the country.
In fact, that got some of the biggest cheers. Let's hear what he had to say about the military.
I became a Republican because I believe America must remain the leader of the free world. Republican leadership, a Republican president, will bring greater conviction and coherence to our foreign policy and will guarantee that our armed forces remain the strongest and most capable on earth.
Last night, Colin Powell addressing the GOP convention, talking about the military, which again got some of the biggest applause. And I should say the royalty, that is the line of chairs that had Liddy Dole, Robin Dole underneath, Robin Dole next to her, and also Dan Quayle, Marilyn Quayle, the McCains, Senator McCain of Arizona, and President Ford, who also spoke last night, and Betty Ford. They would often go to their feet. And they did, I must say, stand up when he talked about it being a party of inclusion. And after he talked about his pro-choice stance and affirmative action, they all had to stand up. I think the press was looking at them most of all.
We'll be back and discuss Colin Powell, the Republican Party, what's coming up tonight, what's coming up on the rest of this show. This is Democracy Now!, live from San Diego, California. I'm Larry Bensky with Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. We'll be right back. Mm-hmm.
Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. Now, you've heard the words of Colin Powell. We'll be playing some more in just a few minutes. But a lot of this is window dressing, I'm afraid to say, when you've got Susan Molinari and Christine Todd Whitman, both pro-choice, coming up tonight. You had Colin Powell. As Juan was saying, there is the GOP platform, and it's not what Colin Powell represents. Well, let's take a look, though, at not only what Colin Powell says, but what he does at his record. And this is something that is not extensively gone through in the mainstream media. We're going to go to Bob Perry, who is an investigative journalist who has looked at the record of Colin Powell and has also done some extensive research into Bob Dole. Bob Dole is senator. And an investigation, he says he tried to obstruct into a Kansas oil company called Coke Oil. He was not alone in trying to obstruct it. It's called the Coke Four, and he was along with Senator McCain and Senator Don Nichols of Oklahoma, two of the people it was considered he was going to be choosing as a vice presidential candidate before he went into before he chose Jack Kemp. But before we go to Bob Perry, we're going to play another of Colin Powell's comments, his comments on welfare last night at his speech at the Republican convention.
The message we must convey to the American people is that we fight for health care reform, we fight for welfare reform and other reforms, not just to save money, because we believe there are better ways to take care of Americans in need than the exhausted programs of the past. We must be firm, but we must also be fair. We have to make sure that reduced government spending doesn't single out the poor and the middle class. Corporate welfare, welfare for the wealthy, must be first in line for elimination. All of us, my friends, all of us must be willing to do with less from government if we are to avoid condemning our children and grandchildren with a crushing burden of debt that will deny them the American dream. My friends, Let me put it to you. We all need to understand it is the entitlement state that must be reformed and not just the welfare state. And we must do it in a way that does not paint all of government as the enemy.
All of government as the enemy, Juan Gonzalez. What is he trying to get at there? I noticed that his remarks about reforming corporate welfare received the weakest applause from anything he said last night. But yet there seemed to be some enthusiasm on the floor for his saying we really do need something like a safety net.
Yeah, there's no doubt that Powell repeatedly now has taken up the moderate wing, I guess, of the Republican Party as a standard bearer, and he's basically was allowed this opportunity to provide the only real dissent in the party because he is a general, because he is not a career politician, and because he is important in terms of the party being able to broaden its image. What's happened here is that you have a core content which is totally different from now the marketing of that content that is going out to the American people, because the whole evening had not only General Powell, but many of the speakers were from the more moderate wing of the Republican Party, and even the faces that were put on stage of African Americans and Latinos. And my favorite was the African American welfare mother who had reformed herself and was now a business person.
Praise God, she's been saved.
Right, she was saved. Right. so that this is the image now. You're marketing the party in one way, but yet the core content of what it stands for is distinctly different.
Well, let's take a look at how moderate Colin Powell is. We are joined by Bob Perry, who is a journalist with the AP, Associated Press, for many years, as well as Newsweek, broke the Iran-Contra story more than 10 years ago. And he has been doing an investigation into Bob Dole. But before we talk about that, you have profiled Colin Powell in your newsletter consortium. Can you talk a little about who Colin Powell is?
Well, Amy, I think Colin Powell is not who people sort of know him as. The media has been extremely lenient in dealing with Colin Powell for a lot of reasons, and one is that he does represent a sort of moderate wing of the Republican Party, and many in the media feel that that's a position that needs to be presented. But if one looks back at Colin Powell's real record, which is what Norman Solomon and I have tried to do in a series we've done in the consortium, you find that there's a great deal of difference between what Colin Powell is thought of and what he's actually done. And we took it back to the days of Vietnam when he often was on the wrong side, where he was often making the wrong conclusions, even when people around him, other advisors in 1963 and other military leaders in 1968, were raising serious questions about the whole policy in Vietnam. Colin Powell was generally on board and not rocking the boat. In 63, he was one of the early advisors in Vietnam. And when Colonel John Paul Vann and other advisors were seeing problems with the policy of burning down villages and trying to force Vietnamese into these strategic hamlets, Colin Powell was not objecting to that policy and, in fact, carrying it out rather enthusiastically. He describes in his memoirs how he would set fire to these Vietnamese homes with Zippo lighters. And unlike many people who were seeing the problems then, he didn't. In 68, he is back in Vietnam for a tour with the AmeriCal division right after My Lai. And when some of the AmeriCal soldiers are raising serious questions about the treatment that had been afforded Vietnamese civilians, Colin Powell doesn't see it. And he, in fact, defends AmeriCal when some of the early allegations that we now know as the My Lai massacre begin to come forward.
Bob Perry, let's fast forward a little bit to a story that you and I are all too familiar with, Iran-Contra. Colin Powell played a role there, too, which has never really been talked about very much.
Right.
Could you tell the listeners a little bit about that?
Sure. People don't realize how important Colin Powell was to the Iran-Contra scandal. If it had not been for Colin Powell and his activities inside the Pentagon, working at the behest of Colonel Oliver North back in 1985, we probably would not have had the scandal. In that time frame, the Pentagon had put in some very strict restraints on how covert operations would be handled. There had been a scandal known as Yellow Fruit, and money had been misappropriated. So the Pentagon, while protecting the secrecy of these operations, had brought into place very strict rules about how this would be handled. When the Iran-Contra affair, when the idea of sending weapons to Iran is first being pushed in mid-85 and then late 85 and then into 86, it is Colin Powell who in effect jerry-rigs the system. He's working at that time as the chief military advisor to Caspar Weinberger, the defense secretary, and he puts in place a special program which allows all the safeguards to be bypassed and allows these weapons to go on to Iran. People inside the Pentagon later said if they had known at all what they were doing, they would have objected and stopped it right there. But it was Colin Powell who made it all happen.
Well, if Colin Powell has this kind of background, I think that there's a real default in the American political system as to why more people don't know about this. And that default is that, aside from the media, there's only one other entity in our culture that can bring such things to political light, and that is the opposing political party, the Democrats. Yet under Bill Clinton, the Democrats have been running as fast as they can from anything that might be seen as an anti-military stance for the reasons of Clinton trying to protect his own biography. And so the Democrats have really never gone at Colin Powell.
Well, that's true. And the Democrats really never went at Iran-Contra either. The problem that we've had in the 80s was that you had a Republican party under Ronald Reagan and George Bush, which lied with zest, and you had a Democratic party under people like Tom Foley and Lee Hamilton and Mitchell and Inouye and a whole bunch of others who didn't want to stand up and tell the truth either. They were afraid. They thought it would be, it might be too disruptive. They thought they'd be accused of being unpatriotic or whatever, but they did not insist that the truth be told.
Tom Foley said he didn't want to shake the presidency, the institution, by investigating George Bush for Iran-Contra.
Well, that's right. And I think there was actually in early 87, when the Iran-Contra congressional investigation was just beginning, there were meetings that the Democratic leadership held. Jim Wright was there, and I've talked to him and many of the staff people I've talked to. And it was decided not to implicate Ronald Reagan in the Iran-Contra scandal. It was to effectively telling the investigators that is not an avenue you can go down, because there was a concern about having another Watergate, of having that kind of disruption. But the price that was paid by the American people and by our history was that essentially a false history was prepared. And the Democrats share a great deal of that blame, as well as the Republicans.
Bob, what about Powell's role as America's military chief in the Persian Gulf War? What have you been able to analyze about his role there?
Well, actually, there's actually a very interesting story out of that that goes to what happened right before the ground war started. And if one analyzes Schwarzkopf's memoirs versus Powell's memoirs, you find out a very fascinating story, which was that, as you know, the air war had been going on for some time, and there had been great destruction inflicted on the Iraqis. They were basically about to quit. They were about to leave Kuwait. They had contacted Gorbachev, who was then running the Soviet Union, Russia at that point. Gorbachev was brokering a peace deal to get the Iraqis out. This upset President Bush, who really wanted his ground war. Back in Saudi Arabia, however, Schwarzkopf was very concerned. He had led troops in Vietnam through minefields, and was very shaken by those experiences, and did not want to do it again if he didn't have to. So he contacts General Powell back in Washington, and the two of them decide that they will favor a weeks-long lapse in the air war to allow the Iraqis to withdraw. This is a message that they agree to, and that Colin Powell is supposed to take back to the White House. Powell arrives at the White House. Bush is pacing the Oval Office, very upset because Gorbachev has stabbed him in the back trying to arrange a peace agreement. And Powell raises his hand, and Bush says, "You know, Colin," and Powell proposes that, well, what they should do. This is Thursday night, getting toward midnight. And what Powell proposes, instead of a week-long ceasefire, to have it only go till noontime on Saturday, when there is no way the Iraqis could move out, and that way there would be the appearance of trying to be reasonable, but the ground war could go forward. Bush thinks this is a brilliant idea, and immediately goes out and announces to the press that there'll be that the Iraqis have until noon on Saturday to get out. Back in Tehran, the commanders, Schwarzkopf and his top generals, look at each other and say, well, we're going to war. And then they go out and prepare for the ground war. But what you see often is that Colin Powell is not a person who was willing to stand up and to challenge his superiors. And that's a course that he has followed throughout when it came to his military career. He was a bureaucrat in that sense, and a clever one and a smart one, and in many ways a very capable one. But he was not a man of courage and not a man who would go against the grain.
I think it's always interesting on Colin Powell that everyone waited with bated breath to see, was he a Republican or was he a Democrat? I think that simply indicates that they're so close together that he could have gone one way or the other. But we want to talk about the man he was speaking up for last night, Colin Powell, saying Bob Dole is a plain-talking kind of guy. Let's also talk about the investigation you've just recently completed that appears in the latest Nation magazine into Bob Dole, the presidential candidate's connections to Coke Oil, a local Kansas oil company. Can you talk about what happened there? Certainly it's not something we've been hearing a lot about.
No, but it's a very interesting story, and it goes back to the late 80s when there were allegations that Coke Oil had been stealing oil from its suppliers, and some of them were Indian reservations. So there was an investigation that was launched by the Senate Indian Affairs Committee in 88 and 89, headed by Senator DeConcini and Senator McCain, both from Arizona, from differing parties. They were proceeding and finding out that there were apparently serious problems involving Coke Oil. At that point, Coke Oil and its executives become very concerned. They begin to contact people with influence. For a long time, though, even though they were a Kansas firm, they had not been close to Bob Dole. In fact, the Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch, were billionaires and two of the richest men in America, but they were libertarians. They favored, they did not like the Republicans almost as much as they didn't like the Democrats.
One of them ran for vice president, didn't he, on the libertarian ticket?
That's correct. David Koch ran for vice president in 1980 on the Libertarian ticket. So they were not longtime Dole supporters. And when you get to 1989, though, they need some help. And they turn to Dole, and they turn to Kassebaum and Nichols and Boren to see if they can put pressure on the Indian Affairs Committee. And they have trouble getting to Dole because they have not been supporters of his. They hire Bob Strauss to show the bipartisan nature of how Washington works. They hire Bob Strauss, the former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, to do the entree. And Strauss sets up a breakfast at the Watergate between one of the Koch executives and Bob Dole.
And that's because Strauss is a good friend of Dole's?
Correct. Strauss, as being a major fixer in Washington, is also close to people of power, and that includes Bob Dole.
And he owns a condominium in the same complex in Florida, we should say, Bob Strauss does, as Bob Dole and Duane Andreas of Archer Daniels Midland. There is such a thing as a ruling class in the United States.
Not to mention David Brinkley, who has also a condominium in the same Andreas complex.
Wouldn't you like to be a fly on the wall of that swimming pool when they're all down there chatting? Anyway, go ahead, Bob Perry.
So Dole suddenly realizes that he ought to come to the aid of the Koch brothers here, and he and the other three senators, Nichols, Boren, and Kassebaum, begin to write letters to the Indian Affairs Committee. Even though they're not members of the committee, they begin to attack the investigation. They zero in on one individual in particular who was just one of the witnesses. There were dozens of witnesses who were describing this theft of oil, alleged thefts of oil, and including an FBI agent who had been involved in staking out six of these operations when the oil was taken. And he found in all six cases the Koch gauger, as they're called, the person collecting the oil, had taken more than he'd paid for. So there was substantial evidence. Also, they also had internal records from Koch showing that $31 million had been taken in oil that hadn't been paid for. So they had a lot of evidence, but Dole and the other three senators zero in on this fellow named Christopher Tucker, who just happened to have been one of the guys who testified before the committee. And they basically try to tear him apart, and they find little discrepancies in his testimony and put enormous pressure on him.
Bob, before we get too much into the minutiae of that, why isn't the Justice Department involved in this? Why is this a matter for congressional investigation and not for possible prosecution? You're basically talking about something that sounds like a crime here.
Well, the case. Well, there were allegations here of theft, which is a crime. Now, but what happens in the Senate is interesting. DeConcini and McCain stick to their guns, and they are not backed off despite the pressure. The case then goes to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Oklahoma City, where a political ally of Nichols is put in as U.S. Attorney. And although the prosecutor feels she has a strong case, it gets sidetracked and ultimately goes nowhere. So the case dies in Oklahoma City. There is a separate civil case that's going on and continued to go on, brought by one of the Koch brothers, who feels is the two brothers in charge of the company here. Are not playing straight. He has continued this case, and now the Justice Department is back in the case. There's a grand jury underway right now in Corpus Christi, Texas, looking at allegations of illegal oil dumping by Koch Oil, as well as some of these older issues of whether they had stolen oil, whether they had falsified other of their records.
Bob Perry, we're going to continue to talk about this investigation and the investigations also that are not taking place into Koch Oil and what Bob Dole, the Republican presidential candidate, has to do with them after we take this break. And then after we finish speaking with you, we're going to go to the Log Cabin Republicans. They've just finished their convention also here in San Diego. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from the San Diego convention site of the Republican National Party that's taking place here this week. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky and Juan Gonzalez, our guest, Bob Perry, investigative journalist with The Nation. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us.
Thank you.
is Democracy Now!, the program that dares to ask the questions the corporate media won't. I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky and Juan Gonzalez. And we're continuing our discussion of an investigation The Nation magazine has done with Bob Parry, investigative journalist, into the Coke oil scandal and the Coke Four.
Bob Parry, what you're in essence telling us here that this Kansas-based oil company, Coke Oil, and the Coke family, their foundations, and their and the employees of the company have given hundreds of thousands of dollars to over the last few years to Dole, several others of these Republican senators, and the Republican committee in an attempt to basically influence them to abort or stop these investigations. Is this just part of the normal buying of influence in Congress, or has your research indicated that Dole here has gone even over the limits of the normally corrupt nature of Washington politics?
Well, Juan, I think it's a good example of how it works, perhaps in larger letters than usual. The Koch family is extremely rich. They also control three of the large foundations. There's the Charles Koch, David Koch, and Claude Lamb foundations, which have been very important in building the right-wing infrastructure in Washington. You have, for instance, groups like the Citizens for Sound Economy, which is leading the fight against the FDA right now.
And the Cato that Institute. They
also founded the Cato Institute.
Right.
They have spent literally millions, not hundreds of thousands, but tens of millions of dollars building this conservative infrastructure in Washington. So this is a bit of a...
Wasn't the founding patriarch of the family also a founder of the John Birch Society? So.
That's correct. Frederick Koch was one of the founders of the John Birch Society. His sons have tended more toward the libertarian conservatism, but what they realized, and they realized it sort of in the late 80s when this problem arose, as one of their executives told me the other day, he said, we did not have corporate defense capabilities, was the way he described it. I think it's an elegant way of picturing this. They realized they needed more political muscle, juice, as we might say in D.C., to make sure that when they got in trouble, when they encountered problems with environmental law or with this kind of more criminal law on the question of stealing, that they would be able to have allies that could help them out. And that is, in a sense, what Washington does a lot. It doesn't, but because it happens often, doesn't make it any better. And in this case, I think the stakes were higher than usual because the Kochs have since this happened, the Kochs have turned their huge fortunes and their infrastructure, the kinds of conservative infrastructure they've built, CSE, for instance, the Citizens for Sound Economy, they've worked much more closely with the Republicans. David Koch is now a vice chairman of the of Dole's finance committee. Part of his job is to help line up more deep pockets so Dole can have a stronger run for the presidency. So in a way, yes, it is business as usual, and to a degree, though, it is extreme business as usual.
Well, Bob Parry, people can get a look at what you have investigated into the Coke Four, and particularly into Bob Dole and Coke Oil in Kansas. If you pick up the latest issue of The Nation magazine, it's also on the website of The Nation. And, Bob, you have your own consortium, the newsletter you put out, in which you profiled Colin Powell and others. Do you have an 800 number where people can find out about it?
Right. If people want more information about the consortium, we can get it to them in the mail. They can call 1-800-738-1812.
One more time.
That's 1-800-738-1812.
Bob Parry, thanks very much for joining us. Bob Parry, investigative reporter who just put out this article and investigation into the latest Nation magazine. He heads up the Nation magazine's investigative unit. You're listening to Democracy Now! Well, this year marks the first time there are openly gay delegates to the Republican National Convention, three to be exact, and two delegates. The Log Cabin Republicans is a national organization of clubs of gay Republicans. Right now, the group is struggling with the decision over whether to endorse Bob Dole for president. Pacifica's Julie Drizin went to the Log Cabin Convention, which just wrapped up here in San Diego, and spoke with members about the role of gays in the GOP.
We're supportive of what other gays and lesbians want to do. Those are generally gay and lesbian Democrats. We have a very unique role. We're trying to work within the party. You know, it's very easy to be on the outside throwing stones, and you can feel very self-righteous and feel very good about yourself. That's not generally, if you look at history, how progress is made. Progress is usually made by people going on the inside, people refusing to move from one seat to another, you know, working and saying, I'm not moving. So I think we just have very different roles. I think the only question I have about Voices 96 is Bill Clinton's record on gay and lesbian issues, despite a lot of the rhetoric, has not been very good. And are they organizing the same effort in Chicago? My understanding is organized labor is funding a lot of Voices 96 and a lot of the protests that are taking place here. Frankly, our chief enemy in races around the country for our moderate Republicans is not the Christian Coalition. It's organized labor. When you look at our moderate Republicans in swing districts, labor is pumping money in there. So they are not allies to log cabin Republicans, and that's not somebody I think I want to be on a platform with right now.
Reagan is, Ronald Reagan is my political idol, I would say. He's the person that got me most enthused about politics, and I would say I decided that I want to be a speechwriter because of Ronald Reagan, because his speeches moved me and inspired me in a way that I haven't found any other candidate or president since then to inspire me.
One of the things that Reagan is most famous for is not saying a word about the AIDS epidemic, which is so devastated the gay community,
right,
until his second term.
Right, but I think it was a different time and place, and I'd like to know how many groups actually tried to talk to the White House about AIDS. I think there's a blame to go around. You know, sure, I wish Ronald Reagan had talked about it sooner, but it was a different time, and I don't blame him for the AIDS crisis in the way that a lot of people do. You know.
There was a healthcare crisis in America, an epidemic that was wiping out thousands and thousands of gay people. And the president, who's supposed to rise us all to a higher level of commitment and compassion, didn't breathe a word about the AIDS virus.
But he did in a second term. So, you know, your characterization is that it was late. But yes, he could have spoken more. But yes, the gay community could also have tried to work with the Republicans more instead of sitting on the outside and screaming that, you know, the Republicans were all evil, which is what they, in a lot of ways, still continue to do. That's why we're around, because we want to stay in the party and educate the party on these issues. I mean, I think the way Republicans have treated AIDS in the Congress has been quite commendable.
The test for Bob Dole that every Republican and every American is waiting to see how he does, the test for Bob Dole is going to be, is he going to be his own man? Is he going to lead this party? And is he going to have a message that is inclusive and that every American can rally behind? And if he does that, it's likely he'll be the next president. If it's not, then I think he'll be missing an opportunity, and so will the party, and that would be a big, a really tragic mistake right now. And it's certainly something Log Cabin's going to be watching, because we're only going to support people who are inclusive, people who want our support. We're not going to go chasing after people to give them our support when it's clearly not wanted. So we're going to have them ask for our endorsement.
And those are Log Cabin Republicans speaking at the Log Cabin Convention, which just wrapped up here in San Diego. And we're joined by two Log Cabin Republicans live on the phone and in our studio here at the Marriott outside the Republican National Convention Center. We're joined by David Greer, who's a spokesperson for the Log Cabin Republicans, and Abner Mason, one of three delegates and two alternates. He's from Massachusetts, and he works in the administration of Governor William Weld, who won't be speaking at this convention because of a stance on abortion. Well, let me ask you, David Greer, about this test for Bob Dole. What is going to happen around an endorsement or not an endorsement?
On Sunday, we decided to delay an endorsement for the Dole Kemp ticket to give them every opportunity to publicly request an endorsement from Log Cabin Republicans. One of the things we wanted to have happen at our convention, which just completed on Sunday, was to have people, a senior official from the Dole campaign, come to our convention and ask for the endorsement. It was unfortunate because most of the senior officials on the Dole campaign were still in Kansas with the vice presidential announcement and really weren't here.
Well, they're not in Kansas anymore.
They're not in Kansas anymore, but we're not here either. I mean, most of our delegates left on Sunday. And as our press release stated, you know, because our schedules didn't correspond, we want to give them every opportunity this week to publicly ask for our endorsement along those lines. So what we did is we voted to delay the endorsement to Friday. Our endorsements committee will make a recommendation on Friday, either to endorse or not endorse, and then we're going to do a certified mail ballot to all the delegates to our convention that they can mail back in. It was the only position we were in. The information we were getting from the Dole campaign, and we're going to take them on their word. We are going to give them every opportunity. And that it was chaotic, and the people were not here. So along those terms, you know, that's what we're looking for.
Can I get both of your reactions to the Republican Party platform plank, which reads as follows? We oppose discrimination based on sex, race, age, creed, or national origin, and will vigorously enforce anti-discrimination statutes. We reject the distortion of those laws to cover sexual preference.
Hateful, vile language.
And yet you're considering endorsing the presidential candidate who is going to run on this platform.
You know, run on this platform, yet everything you read is how, one, he hasn't read it, two, he seems to be distancing himself from this platform, and three, I don't think platforms run parties. You know, I think it's a nominee. What we're looking for is Bob Dole and how gays and lesbians will be treated in his administration.
Well, let's ask Abner Mason, who is a delegate from Massachusetts to the Republican convention. Have you endorsed this platform?
Me personally?
Yes. Do you support it?
No, I think that there are some parts of the platform that are very good and that I absolutely support. There are some parts of it, and they're minor parts, but they're important, that I don't support. I think the platform on balance is a net negative because it has language like the language that was just read, so it's a net negative. I think that David's right, though. Platforms don't run for president. Platforms don't mean a whole lot. Bob Dole says that he said more than in the last few days that he's not going to be bound by a platform that he hasn't read. I think that the platform is overhyped. The platform is really most important to Republican activists because it reflects who has power within Republican activist circles.
It also reflects homophobia, doesn't it, in the passage we just read?
But Bob Dole wanted to put language in the platform that involved more tolerance, and he lost. So what the platform represents is the undue influence, and it's the over-influence of a small minority of far-right sort of extremists. And so as a result, the platform is a net negative. I'm not concerned about the platform. I'm much more concerned. In fact, I think most Americans are concerned and should be concerned about what Bob Dole thinks and what kind of administration Bob Dole wants to have.
But
not that important.
In the convention itself, which Bob Dole clearly controls, and last night's opening events clearly showed a much more openness or inclusive message, and yet even there, none of the speakers, or there was no indication that there was any opening to the gay and lesbian community.
Well, I think you have to also realize, let's look, Mary Fisher did speak about gay men for the first time in her AIDS speech. And I know that most people want to hear, you know, far more inclusive language, but we in Log Cabin Republicans understand that these baby steps are huge, giant steps when it comes to party activities. And for her to get up there again and talk about the AIDS crisis as compassionately as she did, and those people, you saw them, they were weeping. They were, you know, and so there is some movement, and the inclusion, I think they learned that a Nuremberg rally from 1992 doesn't appeal to the broad center of American politics.
Congressman Gunderson didn't speak. I was going to say the only openly gay Republican, but now there are two, mm-hmm. with Jim Colby of Arizona, who was outed last week.
No, Congressman Gunderson did not speak, but I don't think that was a priority for Gunderson himself. I mean, he wanted another role in the convention to work in the caucuses along those lines, and he is doing that. So.
Congressman Gunderson has said he's not running for re-election in part because he was told by Newt Gingrich that he would basically be gay-baited if he ran.
Well, you know, that is not gay-baited in his race. There would be a challenge to for the chairmanship of the ag seat. Along those lines. And I think that's just, that's what would happen. I mean, that's a reality. That would happen. Now, is that, you know, I don't think that was false rhetoric. I mean, there would probably be a challenge from the religious activists, far-right activists in Congress.
Now, we want to refresh our listeners' memory. People may go back a couple months and remember that Bob Dole returned a $1,000 contribution that his campaign actually solicited from the log cabin Republicans. Now you're waiting to see if he will accept your endorsement before you endorse him. Why should it matter which way? And what does Bob Dole have to gain from you endorsing him?
Well, let me tell you, one of the things that has always hurt this party is the view of the extremist label. And one of the things that Log Cabin brings to the table, I think, is for those tolerant and swing voters out there, that if you have a party that the Log Cabin Republicans, that they can endorse this nominee, a party all the way from now that Buchanan has endorsed, if Log Cabin does endorse, this will be the most unified convention. So what you can see is that for those people, suddenly, if they feel that the gay and lesbian group in the Republican Party wants to endorse the nominee, that it isn't the extreme party of Houston. There has been movement. So that is why it is important, one, to make this endorsement.
Abner Mason, let me ask you something about how this is playing back home. Obviously, Governor Weld there is in a tight race with current Senator Kerry trying to win that seat in Massachusetts for a Republican. What is the relevance of the tolerance issue here in San Diego to things going on back home in Massachusetts?
I think it's probably the most important thing. In 1992, the Republican Convention, as David said, was really it was a horrible experience. There was a lot of intolerance and bigotry on display, and it was sort of symbolized by the Buchanan speech, and that turned off voters all across the country, including in Massachusetts, to the Republican Party, because people thought that's what the party's like. And so we lost big in 92 because of that. In 96, there was a real commitment on the part of a lot of people, including Log Cabin, to work very hard to make sure that 96 was not like 92. And in 96, instead of Pat Robertson and Pat Buchanan speaking in 96, Buchanan was not allowed to speak, and we have Colin Powell, we've got Susan Molinari, we've got Jack Kemp on the ticket. This convention could not be more different than 92. It's a polar opposite. This convention has really been an example of a party learning its lesson and understanding that it really has to reach out to every voter who shares the party's basic values. Bob Dole has really succeeded in doing what a lot of people thought he couldn't do, and that is to say, this party is going to be a mainstream party. We're going to focus on that 80% of things that unite Republicans, and we're just not going to focus on the 20% that divide Republicans.
And I assume that in Massachusetts, that in Massachusetts, when William Weld is campaigning, Senator Kerry is going to read out loud what I just read from the Republican platform, saying the Republicans are a party that is basically homophobic, that rejects sexual preference as a criterion for anti-discrimination. How are you going to answer that?
I think that if the election in Massachusetts ends up being about John Kerry reading from the platform, most voters are going to say, that's a platform I never heard and don't care about. But what I saw at the Republican convention is Colin Powell and Susan Molinari and Jack Kemp. I think that it's a real mistake for John Kerry to do that. If he wants to run his campaign on the Republican platform, he's welcome to do it. But I think that's a mistake. In fact, I'd advise him to do that, because I think in Massachusetts, it's a tremendous mistake to run a campaign against Bill Weld about the Republican platform.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Abner Mason, delegate from Massachusetts in the Republican Convention, and also David Greer, spokesperson for the Log Cabin Republicans. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez and Larry Bensky. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! From the Republican National Convention in San Diego, this is Democracy Now! The GOP attack on immigration and affirmative action leads to the largest protests outside the convention yet.
What stands before you now is a mujer that did not give up her summer, but dedicated her summer to the movimiento and to the movement. A mujer that dedicated herself to the struggles that we need to overcome. I plan and I will overcome the barriers and obstacles that are put forth in front of me.
Late-term abortions, a curse word for the Republican Party. We'll talk with a woman who had one about why. And we go back to the Republican Convention of 1972. Nixon wanted it in San Diego until the ITT scandal broke. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And I'm Amy Goodman. Welcome to our second hour of Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only a daily election show. In this segment, I'm joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez, columnist with the Daily News. Juan, there has been a lot of attention outside of this convention and even before it started this past weekend around the issues of immigration and affirmative action.
Oh, most certainly. And I think in San Diego, an area of the United States with such a large Latino population, about 40% of the surrounding area, and the largest border city in the United States, it comes as no surprise that with the Republican Party's plank on immigration, that there would be such attention by many Latino groups in the area to the convention. So I think that it's definitely one of the major issues that's arisen.
Well, yesterday, actually, there was one of the largest demonstrations I've seen here. Several hundred Latino youth rallied yesterday in San Diego's Chicano Park to save affirmative action in the state of California. Ayoko Bettini-Buedlock was there and has this report.
It was mostly young Latinos who gathered at Chicano Park to protest Proposition 209, the anti-affirmative action initiative in this November's ballot in California. They urged fellow Californians to vote against the so-called California Civil Rights Initiative and carried signs saying, "Read between the lies."
Prop 209 is a means to keep our people misinformed, and it means for people in this country to think that they can subjugate us, that they can control us, and they can keep us where they want us to keep us. What I have to say to that is that they're wrong. That's not going to happen. We were here first. This is Aslan.
A lot of these youth are sacrificing their summer vacation to march and hold rallies, all to bring attention to CCRI. Monica Hernandez, one of the marchers, says she's just that committed to the struggle.
What stands before you now is a mujer that did not give up her summer, but dedicated her summer to the movimiento and to the movement. A mujer that dedicated herself to the struggles that we need to overcome. I plan and I will overcome the barriers and obstacles that are put forth in front of me.
It seems that young people are overcoming one major obstacle, and that is to get people interested, involved, or just listening. Hundreds showed up for the rally, one of the largest so far at the Republican National Convention. Dave Valadeed, vice president of the Chicano Federation, gives the youth all the credit for getting the issues out there.
I applaud the students who have organized this marcha. You, as students, are simply fulfilling the role that students have always played in every society, and that is you're the conscience of a society. You tell the society when it's going in the wrong direction, and this state is going in the wrong direction if they allow CCRI to pass.
Although some of the marchers are not yet of voting age, they know that the future of affirmative action in the state, and to some extent their own futures, are in the hands of voters. They hope when Californians go to the polls this November, they will reject the measure that many believe will deny equal opportunity to women and people of color. In San Diego, this is Ayoka Bettini-Buedlock reporting.
And thanks for that report, Ayoka. I should say that from that demonstration in Chicano Park, it grew to about 1,000 people when it made it to the freedom of speech pen, as we say, across two railroad tracks from the convention. It was a massive, really, for this kind of the kind of protests that have been happening here, a really large protest outside the Republican convention. And people came in with tremendous energy. It was a coalition of groups from the National Organization of Women to the Feminist Majority to a number of pro-immigrant groups. groups and the United Farm Workers. Speaking of which, we are joined by Dolores Huerta, founder of and currently vice president of the United Farm Workers. She was one of those who spoke yesterday at the anti-CCRI rally. We're also joined by Juan Jose Gutierrez, who is with One Stop Immigration Center in California, and Ramon Hernandez. He is a Latino Republican delegate from Texas. He's chairman of the Republican National Hispanic Assembly of Harris County, Texas. And this should lead to an interesting discussion. In fact, Juan, you met Ramon yesterday at a minority Republican candidate's breakfast.
Yes, it was a breakfast held yesterday morning for candidates, both African-American and Latino, who are running for office, but there were many of the Hispanic and African-American delegates who also attended. And I think that the clearly the immigration issue, especially given the all-inclusive message that General Colin Powell presented last night, has to raise some questions among African-American and Latino delegates who are here to the convention. And I'd like to start with Ramon Hernandez, you have, as you told me yesterday, you come from the most conservative county in Texas, Harris County around Houston. What's been your perspective on the immigration plank in your party?
Well, like I keep reiterating and talking to people, we need to put the plank and the platform into context. A plank and a platform is just a guidance. It's suggestions from the platform committee on where the party should be headed to. What we need to look for in the Republican Party, and we have great examples of this, is leadership examples of positive immigration policies. And we saw that last night with Colin Powell. In fact, he had the loudest response in the arena when he mentioned his example of cherishing a Hispanic immigrant who just became a citizen just as much as cherishing a Mayflower descendant. And I was in that hall, I know you were in that hall, and let me just tell the listeners that when that line was said, there was no dissension. Everyone agreed in unanimity, and it was well received. So with leadership examples like Colin Powell, or Jack Kemp, who stood up against Proposition 187, and Governor George Bush, who did the same, we have examples in the Republican Party saying we want Hispanics and Latinos to be part of our party.
But what about the citizenship issue in terms of children of undocumented or illegal immigrants? What's your sense of that, of the platform, your personal view?
I think the sense, once again, the platform committee, while we have good-natured people, there are serious concerns. It's reactionary. It hasn't been thought out through. As a conservative, I am very concerned just based on the fact that here as Republicans, we're advocating less government intrusion, and we're tinkering with the Constitution when we do that. And once we start tinkering with the Constitution to advocate social policy, then I tell my Republican brethren, we're just acting like Democrats, that we cannot do that, and it's getting well received when it's put into that context.
Juan Jose Gutierrez, in terms of the impact of this plank, because it seems that on the one hand, the Republican Party is attempting to present for the television audience a much more all-inclusive perspective to the nation. On the other hand, the platform itself is dominated by the most conservative and right-wing elements of the party. What's your sense of how this is impacting on the Latino community and in general California community?
Well, let us begin by saying that the fact of the matter remains that for years now, the Republican Party and some of the main ideologues, you know, let's name a few of them, Pat Buchanan, Newt Gingrich, Bob Dole, and a few others, they have presented and led some of the most conservative and damaging immigration policies to Latinos and immigrants in general. The fact that all of a sudden, 3 months before a national election, modifications and changes to the image of the party is presented by way of the vice presidential nomination of Mr. Bob Dole, of Jack Kemp, and the speech made yesterday by General Colin Powell, that does not mean that the fundamental vision and policies advocated by a majority of the Republican Party all of a sudden evaporates and is transformed into something else. The fact remains that there is great dissension within the Republican Party, and I think that Ramon just mentioned, where that is coming from. There are individuals, important voices of the Republican Party, that believe that what the Republican Party has been doing over the last few years is wrongheaded and ultimately will do great damage to the strategic political interest of the Republican Party, because we all know that to the extent that 95 to 98% of the entire Latino population are United States citizens or legal residents in the process of massively embracing American citizenship, the fact will become soon where Latinos will become a fundamental component of any political equation which will bring about fundamental change, not only in the state of California, but across those states in America where we are significant percentages of the population. Therefore, if the Republican Party does not immediately effect radical change in its immigration policies and messages, I think that the party will become the party of the past and certainly will have no political future in the United States.
But Dolores Huerta, you have a long history of involvement with the United Farm Workers, a union that has in the past often been associated with the Democratic Party, and yet we find President Clinton recently agreeing to sign a welfare reform bill that would deny federal benefits to immigrants. You find even the Democratic Party increasingly talking about strengthening the borders and keeping out illegals. What is your sense now in terms of how both parties are dealing with the issue of immigrants to the country and most specifically Latinos?
Well, I think we're getting very close to talking about third parties again. You know, back in Texas, back in the 60s, they talked about the Raza Unida Party, and I think we're going in that direction again. I mean, it's not just the Latinos or the immigrants or all immigrants, but it's you're all talking about the women that are being affected by the millions that are going to be thrown on the street by the Welfare Reform Act. I mean, this is devastating, and I, for one, who was planning to do a lot of work on voter registration and getting out the vote for Democrats, I feel like I've been totally deflated. And the other thing too, in terms of the Republican Party, I just have to say that I think the whole thing is it's a sham, it's a charade, it's hypocritical. First they talked about bringing in a bracero program, bringing in captive workers from Mexico to work. I mean, this is Dole and Wilson and the whole motley bunch of them bringing in captive workers to work, but they can't become citizens. They can't even have legal residence. Just have them work and then send them back to Mexico. It's like they want our production but not our reproduction. And this whole thing about camp, you know, here in California, the Republicans have been lockstep. Every single measure that they've introduced on the national level, and worse, has been introduced in California, to the point they have bills like you can't graduate from high school unless you're a U.S. citizen. So I think this whole thing that they did yesterday with Colin Powell and with Jack Kemp, it's a big sham, it's a big hypocritical thing, because all the legislation that they've introduced on the national level and on the in the state of California and in many other states has been totally anti-immigrant, anti-Latino.
Dolores Huerta, this issue is so polarized, the issue of both immigration and affirmative action. Rarely do you get two sides together. And certainly at this convention, you have the protesters in a pen way off that can hardly be heard by the convention. And so you don't have that dialogue at all. Now we have that opportunity here with Ramon Hernandez, who is a Texan delegate, a Republican delegate. Do you have a question for him?
I guess my question is, how can you even rub shoulders with them? Rub shoulders with these folks that are putting in all of these policies that are very, very racist and anti-immigrant. I mean, how can you even be there?
Plain and simply, because going back to what Juan Jose said, if we have our eggs in one basket, like we do right now as a community with the Democratic Party, our political strength is diminished. The Democratic Party takes us for granted. We have no voice in the Republican Party because we don't participate at the basic level. If we want to have a voice on the platform committee, well, we need to start participating in the precinct conventions. We need to start voting Republican. We need to start being active Republicans. And we need to start either pulling out of the Democrat and becoming independent, or have a base in both parties. But going back to, you brought up an interesting point about California. California has a lot of problems. and their reactions to immigration, and it's led by Governor Wilson. But again, let me state, Texas should be looked on as a shining example. Texas Republicans, from Governor Bush on down, recognize our historic relationship with Mexico. We cherish it. We're cultivating it. And if there's one, if there's an example, a shining star in the Republican Party as far as how Texas Republicans and the Republican Party deals with immigration positively, look to Texas. Look to our leadership. We are not afraid to take a stand. Once again, George Bush says from the very beginning, and this is after he got elected, not before the election, he said we are for against Proposition 187, and he has stated that continuously. He has worked hard to bring in more business from Mexico. And what my point is this, California, its leadership. California, under Governor Wilson, has abdicated their moral responsibilities. There is no question about that. Texas, under Governor Bush, and the Republican Party of Texas has not, and we're leading the way to show there's an alternative vision of positive immigration policy in the United States.
Well, clearly, as Juan Jose was saying earlier, even within the Republican Party, there are strong differences on this. Jack Kemp, representing that wing of the Republican Party that has always seen immigration as something that strengthens and builds the country rather than as a problem that has to be ended. And I think that, as you're saying, in Texas, there is a different approach to this. But in terms of the other issues that affect Latinos, whether it's from the point of view of folks as working people or in terms of education, Juan Jose, what would you say are the impact of Republican policies on the overall Latino community?
Well, the policies of the Republican Party, without question, have been and remain devastating. And I think that these are issues that are not just Latino per se, but they cut across ethnic lines and ultimately affect everyone. Let me mention a few of them. We haven't had effective labor law reform in decades. So right now what you have is a situation where if you want to exercise your legal right to become unionized, it becomes almost a practical impossibility unless you have access to a powerful labor union that has the resources and the legal muscle to keep you within the labor context. You're not going to be able to join a union. Of course, the minimum wage increase, which we've just gotten, is very small, and it really doesn't take working families to the point where they can pull themselves out of poverty. That's one issue. We have the issue of affirmative action, of course, where we're having a lot of double talk by the Republicans. They're telling us minorities that the only way to really have opportunity in this nation is by gutting the very programs that allowed us to get an education and so on.
You know, I wanted to ask Ramon Hernandez, a Latino Republican candidate from Texas. This also, this is an issue that's come up with debates over gay issues around the Defense of Marriage Act, and that is that it's not only where you stand on a particular issue, it's what comes up in that debate. And in that case, it's a lot of anti-gay, anti-lesbian feeling. On the issue of immigration, wherever you stand on how legally immigration should be dealt with, when the debate goes to the floor in Congress, when it's dealt with in the GOP hearings, you hear a lot of anti-immigrant, a lot of racist rhetoric. How does that make you feel?
Well, first of all, to clarify, I'm not a candidate. I'm a delegate.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime we start dealing into rhetoric, we need to analyze where it's coming from. But let me just say this. The concerns that are brought up by Republicans, I believe, are legitimate concerns in dealing that we do have a massive illegal immigration problem. And I'm curious, and I hope I can get a response, what exactly are we advocating here from the left? Are we advocating that we should have open borders, no border patrol? And if so, why? And my concern is we're jumbling too many issues under immigration. We have, one, the illegal immigration problem. Then after that, we have to deal with legal immigration. And then within that context, we deal with the various issues dealing with legal immigrants. So I hope we can get into differentiating that, but starting with basically what are the goals from the left regarding immigration?
Well, I'd like to take an opportunity to respond to that directly. The fact of the matter remains, Ramon, that the problem that we have with the Republican Party and their vision, or your vision, on immigration policy is that the debate has gotten to the point where we have dehumanized human beings, and now we have things that are, seem to be far more important than human beings. In other words, under NAFTA, we have developed now free enterprise zones.
Before you get to the free enterprise zones, I see Dolores nodding her head here. What's your response to what he's saying?
Well, I'd say that it's been created by government. NAFTA has created this massive illegal immigration to the United States. They have thrown millions of people out of work in Mexico through NAFTA. So here we have our own government that's created the problem, and then we blame the victims, which are the people that have to live.
We're going to get one comment on enterprise zones when we come back. We're talking about the issue of immigration. After that, we'll be talking about late-term abortions with two women who had them. And finally, we'll be discussing San Diego, a convention that didn't take place in 1972. You're listening to Democracy Now! Our guest, Dolores Huerta, head of or vice president of the United Farm Workers Union. We're also with Juan José Gutierrez with One Stop Immigration Center in California, and Ramon Hernandez, who is a Latino Republican delegate from Texas. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and we just have a few more minutes with our guest, Dolores Huerta of the United Farm Workers, Juan José Gutierrez of One Stop Immigration Center, and Ramon Hernandez, who is a Latino Republican delegate from Texas.
Juan José, I'd like to ask you, you mentioned the enterprise zones before. That's been a major issue for Jack Kemp over the years. Actually, he teamed with a Puerto Rican congressman from the Bronx, yeah, Bobby Garcia, to initially develop the program. What's your sense of where that is going?
Well, I think that rather than where do I think it's going, we must ask ourselves, how can that be used to really affect immigration policy? The problem we have today is that all the profit which is generated in those enterprise zones or those countries under NAFTA, they're all being brought back to America. So how can one expect people living in those countries where the profit is being extracted from to remain there, where there's no capital remaining to develop those economies? So I think it's really hypocritical to be talking about economic development when the profits do not remain in the areas where you need most of that development to take place.
Ramon, how do you respond to that?
If I may, I still would like my earlier question answered from the groups here representing the left. Are you advocating open borders? Are you saying that the United States has to have an open border? And are you saying that once Latinos get in here, that we owe nothing to the country, that we're trying to become citizens and be a part of? That's what I need to
Dolores, understand. How do you answer that?
Well, first of all, going back to the hypocrisy, the employers that are contributing to Dole and that are members of the Republican Party are the ones that are bringing in the folks to work in the first place. And they're working them at sub-minimum wages and under a lot of exploitation and oppression, right?
But I think Ramon would agree that employer sanctions should be part of an overall immigration policy. But I think the question
is there.
Are open borders?
Well, we're not advocating
it's not
open
enforced.
Borders.
Yeah.
We recognize the sovereignty of the United States, and what we're talking about is a humane immigration policy. If you're going to be promoting the massive migration of people to escape poverty and to come into the United States must take a responsibility and institute a policy that promotes people remaining in their countries of origin, but that only is going to happen if we have economic development in those countries.
On that note, we're going to have to wrap up. Today, a Latino summit?
A Latino summit today is being held by many Latino leaders from all over the country that are gathering today to discuss these very issues and what we're going to do about them.
And it's taking place here
in San Diego. It's taking place here in San Diego.
Well, Dolores Huerta, the United Farm Workers, Juan Jose Gutierrez, One Stop Immigration Center of California, and Ramon Hernandez, Latino Republican delegate from Texas, I want to thank you all very much for being with us on Democracy Now!
Little Pedro and Juanita arrived this morning in Reseda on a special overnight delivery. They bubbled and they burbled and they flashed their brown eyes at us. We said check their little heartbeats and their immigration status. And if you should find they're here illegally,
gully,
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 send them back, send them back. Give them one good whack and half an hour to pack. Hand their cousins to the fuzz and stick them on a southbound bus. Restrict immigration, give the country back to us.
Little Helga and her father came across the rolling water on a stormy day in 1923. And he labored as a carpenter so she could be a doctor. Now they convalesce together in the window where he rocked her. And their burdens on the state economy.
Nami,
Nami,
Nami.
Send them back, send them back. Give them one Big Mac and serum Ipecac.
On a steamer back to Bremerhaven, instantaneous.
Restrict immigration, give the country back to us.
Send the Finns back to Finland,
and the Russians further inland.
Send the Poles back to Poland,
and the Penguins to the Poles.
Any man with a tan should go back to Tanzania.
And the Aegeans to a...
Send them back by the foreman here on Democracy Now!
We affirm that the unborn child has a fundamental right to life which cannot be abridged. And we applaud Bob Dole's commitment to sign into law a partial abortion, to end partial birth abortions.
And that is Utah Lieutenant Governor Olene Walker. She was the co-chair, along with Congressmember McCollum of Florida, of the independent, Individual Rights Subcommittee, where they talked about issues of immigration as well as abortion. And she was speaking yesterday when they were voting on the platform, the GOP platform, representing that position. Well, we're going to take on the issue of abortion right now. And certainly the lightning rod of that issue has been the issue of late-term abortion, what the conservatives call the partial birth abortion, but not what pro-choice advocates call it. We are joined by two women who actually have gone through late-term abortions. We're joined by Mary Dorothy Line, who is a Catholic Republican who fought against the late-term abortion bill and was with the president when he vetoed the legislation. We're also joined by Claudia Crown Addis. She's a pro-choice woman who, with her husband Richard, spent a lot of time in Washington lobbying against the late-term abortion bill. She was also with the president when he vetoed the legislation. I'm Amy Goodman, and Larry Bensky joins us again. Tell us about your own experiences, because I think that's what gets lost in all of the theory and all of the debate around abortion. Mary Dorothy Line, why don't we begin with you?
When I was 19 weeks pregnant, through a routine ultrasound, the doctor noticed that our baby's head was too large and that it was filled with excessive fluid, a problem called hydrocephalus. The doctor recommended we wait a few weeks, which of course we would do, and that we have several more ultrasounds. During that time, we had a lot of time to talk and think and pray, and as Catholics, that's what we do, and we really believed that everything would be okay. And I'll never forget my husband and I talking, saying that abortion was not an option, that this was our child, and God wouldn't give us a problem if we couldn't handle it. Well, several weeks later, when we had more ultrasounds, every doctor told us the exact same thing. It was a very advanced textbook case of hydrocephalus. It had started very early in our son's development, and there was no way that he could be born. He would be stillborn. In addition to that, he could not swallow, and his stomach had never developed. So we knew that a child with no brain and no stomach, that there was no possibility, and we knew that when the doctors recommended an intact dilation and evacuation, that that was what we should do.
And what month were you in again?
6 months.
What would have happened to you if the legislation that President Clinton vetoed had been in effect?
First of all, I wouldn't be pregnant again. I'm pregnant right now, 8.5 months. Our baby's due in September.
That's pretty obvious.
Second of all, I don't know. Any number of things could have happened to my health. With our son, his head was already larger than that of a full-term baby, so there was no chance of ever having a normal childbirth, normal delivery. Another procedure that would have been available to me is called a hysterotomy. With a hysterotomy, they cut your uterus in half lengthwise, and they open it up so that they can take the baby out. This would make it so that maybe I could never get pregnant again, because there is severe scarring to the uterus, and it makes it very difficult for a placenta ever to attach again to the uterus. There is also a condition called polyhydramnios, which was developing because our baby could not swallow. And as a result of that, amniotic fluid was building up in my uterus, and my uterus could have ruptured because of that.
You had within you what the Republican Party platform defines as an unborn child, however.
Yes.
And according to the Republican Party platform, they support a human life amendment which would protect the life of that unborn child. In other words, had you had the medical procedure that you had and the Republican Party platform's plank was law, you might well be a criminal for what you did.
Well, they say that the women would not be criminals, that our doctors would have been criminals. And our doctor was actually, Claudia and I were lucky enough to have the same doctor, some of the same doctors. He was actually a saint in our eyes, far from a criminal. He stopped our children from suffering, and he helped us a lot.
Let's get Claudia Crown Addis's story. When were you pregnant?
It was almost 4 years ago, and I was in the 26th week of my pregnancy when, like Mary Dorothy, we were also informed that our baby was riddled with severe anomalies, completely incompatible with life. He had a condition called trisomy 13, where it's a fatal chromosomal disorder. His brain was filled with fluid that prevented further development. He had a severely malformed heart with a hole between the chambers that prevented normal blood flow. He had a giant cyst on the outside of his chest filled with intestinal matter. He had hypertaloric eyes, which are eyes on either side of the head, and many, many, many more anomalies.
Was there any question for you at the time the doctor told you what was going on, whether or not you would have a late-term abortion?
Well, the question is that you don't want to believe the truth. We had the finest doctors that this country has. We had the finest experts in the world telling us that my son stood no chance of survival. And we begged for a cardiologist that could fix his heart or a brain surgeon that could repair his brain. And, of course, the answers were always no. There was nothing that could be done. So we found, I mean, when we were told this, when we went through this, when we talked to doctors and our family and we prayed, we knew that we had no other choice. We needed to stop my son's suffering, and that was our biggest concern at this point.
Under the Hyde Amendment, I don't know what your personal economic circumstance was and is. I'm assuming that you had some sort of way to pay for these medical procedures that you had.
We had insurance, and okay. It was covered under, although it was even difficult in that, because the insurance companies will tell you that it's an elective procedure. Of course, it is an elective procedure, and that's been one of the other arguments of this, where they're telling us that they're saying that these procedures are elective and therefore unnecessary. But that's an entirely
what
different
about
issue.
You, Mary Dorothy? Did you have some sort of insurance coverage? That
yes,
took care
I did.
Of this?
But my husband and I are lucky that my doctor, we asked him if this procedure was not available to us in the U.S., what we could have done. And he believed so strongly, my OBGYN and the perinatologist, the women who perform the ultrasounds, believed so strongly in this procedure being safe and compassionate that they told us they would have sent us to Mexico or Sweden. And my husband and I are lucky enough, while we're not wealthy, we could have scraped together enough money to go to one of those places.
Well, what I wanted to say about finish that about the Hyde Amendment. Henry Hyde was, of course, the chair of the platform committee that drafted these provisions, and one of them is that the Republicans now have in their platform that they oppose, as the Hyde Amendment already does, using public revenues for abortion and will not fund organizations which advocated it. What would have happened to both of you who needed this dire and drastic medical procedure had you been poor women without insurance?
Well, I mean, that really isn't as much... It wasn't an issue for us as much as it might have been for someone else, but in any situation when a woman requires an abortion, it's very difficult, and there are fewer and fewer places where a woman can have access to a safe and legal abortion. In this case, there are only 3 or 4 doctors in the country that actually perform this procedure, and it would have made it that much more difficult.
Claudia, you have always called yourself pro-choice. Mary Dorothy, what about you?
Yeah, even though we were Catholic, my mother raised us that every woman has a right to choose, that it's her body and her emotions and her family are at stake.
You were actually both brought here by the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League to talk to people in San Diego. Is that right?
Yes.
We wanted to play NARAL's new ad that they have right now on this issue.
Bob Dole says he's a doer, not a talker. On abortion, now he's talking tolerance. But look at what he's done. In Congress, Bob Dole voted 107 times against a woman's right to choose. He even voted for a constitutional amendment to overturn Roe v. Wade. And the Dole party platform would make abortion illegal, no exceptions. Call NARAL at $2.75 a minute for the facts about Bob Dole, the 104th Congress, and their record on the right to choose. Because it shouldn't be their choice, it should be yours.
And that is the NARAL ad, National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League. We're talking to Mary Dorothy Lyon and Claudia Crown Addis, two women who had late-term abortions. Claudia.
One of the hardest parts about this is Mary Dorothy and I lobbied Congress and met with so many different people, both from the extreme right as in Congress as well as all these organizations, is that they feel they know what was best for our child. They feel they know more than the doctors. They believe that they're more compassionate about the children that we carried than we are. We wanted what was best for our children, and we desperately wanted these children. But we didn't want them to suffer, and we didn't want them to be in pain. And that was a decision that we could make with our doctors and with our families.
What's your reaction, either of you, when you see the anti-abortion forces parading outside hearings and giving testimony inside hearings with the most graphic descriptions of the medical procedures that you went under, trying to horrify and disgust people about these procedures?
It drives us crazy because they're lying. They're lying about our babies. They're lying about what we went through. The diagrams that they're depicting, these drawings, the words about what they're saying, they're lies. This is not the way the procedures performed. This is not what happened. And they, not only were they not there, not only do they know nothing about our medical records, but they know very little about this procedure, and they know nothing about what we went through.
And that's why I became involved personally, because my husband and I, it had only been 3 months after we had the procedure. And let me tell you, it's an extremely emotional time. I still will never get over this loss. We lost our son. We saw how Washington was portraying the procedure, and we were extremely offended, extremely, because it's not how it's done.
In fact, I have right in front of me a National Right to Life press release, which is saying that they have 4 interviews. A nurse Brenda Pratt Schaefer, who witnessed partial birth abortions in San Diego, and they're making her available
and
for interviews.
And Brenda, we know that not to be true. The doctor who she claims that when she was working for that she witnessed says that she never witnessed the procedure, and because she was working on a temporary basis, would never have witnessed that procedure, would never have been allowed in the operating room.
So what's motivating these lies and distortions on the part of the so-called pro-life
side? It sounds good. You can really offend someone if you say someone jabs scissors into the back of a baby's head and sucks out its brains. What happens is a simple needle is used to remove the fluid from the baby's head. It is extremely safe and extremely compassionate.
This is a spearhead to their agenda, no more, no less. They know that they could take the procedure that is the most intimate, the most tragic, the most horrifying, that's performed on less than 500 women a year, and pull on the heartstrings of America, and that's what they've done. There is no such thing as a partial birth abortion. They have made this up. They have used this term to get to the hearts of America.
They're not the only ones who've used the term. I have rarely seen it referred to as anything else but partial birth.
Unfortunately, it's because
abortion, even in the media.
The pro-choice activists have not gotten out as quickly as the anti-choice people have. And that's the problem.
It is a term that was made up, it was designed to inflame, and it does not exist in any medical textbook, and no doctor has ever used this
expression.
What
do you call it?
It's an intact DNA, an intact dilation and extraction, and that's the proper medical name, and that's what we call it.
There was one delegate on the platform committee who's a medical doctor. I believe she's from Hawaii, and she was taking the point that you were just saying. She was debating this and saying this shouldn't be in the platform. She's saying, I'm a doctor, and I want somebody on this platform to identify for me what is a partial birth abortion. It doesn't exist in medical technology. I'm telling you, I'm a doctor. It doesn't exist. And she was basically
and
using your
argument. And
these
babies are not partially born, and that's what they're trying to imply. And it's disgusting, and it's painful to those of us who had to live through this tragedy. And the one thing that I can say is, if God forbid this happened to any of them, they would want the finest medical care that exists, and they would want access to the best doctors they can have that perform the best surgeries that doctor thinks is the best surgery for that patient.
Have you talked to any Republican delegates, anti-choice delegates?
Yes, actually, yesterday I met Gary Brower and had the opportunity to tell him what I have been through, and he...
Gary Brower of the Family Resource Center, one of the most conservative right-wing groups that are leading the GOP platform fight here.
And he told me that the five of us must be exceptions because he knows the way the procedure is performed, and he knows what goes on, so that we must be exceptions to the rule, and we are not exceptions to the rule. We are women who have chosen to come out and tell our stories and share that, but we are not exceptions to the rule.
Well, we want to thank you both very much for sharing your stories with us today, Mary Dorothy Line and Claudia Crown Addis, two women who had late-term abortions, who had dilation and extractions performed on them. And right now, Mary Dorothy Line, we wish you a comfortable birth, but of good luck with your
thank
new
you.
Baby about to be born in the next month. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Larry Bensky. Larry, tonight, Christine Todd Whitman, the New Jersey governor, will be speaking, and the keynote speaker, Susan Molinari, the New York Congress member, will be speaking as well, addressing the Republican National Convention.
And don't forget Newt Gingrich. This is his big speech night, too.
Actually, Newt Gingrich I didn't see last night, although I did go to the party sponsored by Philip Morris of the Georgia Republicans. Well, we're talking about the 1996 Republican National Convention, but let's go back in time. Let's go back to 1972.
And a mere 24 short years ago, Amy, I and our Pacifica team at that time were getting ready to come to San Diego to cover the Republican Party convention when, lo and behold, it was moved to Miami. We have Bruce McGraw with us, who has just written a series of articles in the San Diego alternative paper about this situation. Bruce, I noticed that in the official Republican program where they list every year's convention, they get to 1972 and they say, because of a series of events, the convention had to be moved from San Diego to Miami. But this series of events was extremely serious. It was part of what eventually became Watergate. And I wondered if we could just break it down into two elements quickly here. The element having to do with ITT, the International Telephone and Telegraph Company, which had subsidized or tried to subsidize the convention because basically that company was trying to buy influence with the Republican Party at the time. Some things never change. We see the same kind of thing going on this time in San Diego. But ITT had, it said, lost properties that had been expropriated by the Chilean government under Salvador Allende. And they wanted the Republicans, the United States government, to overthrow the regime of Allende, which eventually was done. ITT also had a lawsuit problem at that time about antitrust. They were trying to buy, was it the Hartford Insurance Company?
Yeah, the Hartford Fire Insurance Company.
Hartford Fire Insurance Company. And they wanted the Justice Department to back off of antitrust action against them there. What did you find out in your I'm looking at you, and I'm guessing that you didn't live through this series of events as I did, at least not as a functioning journalist. You're too young. But what did you find out in your researches about all of this?
Well, it's an interesting story. I think briefly I should talk about why they initially chose San Diego as a city. Nixon had always loved San Diego. And San Diego had always loved Nixon. He considered it his lucky city ever since 1950 in his race for the Senate against Helen Gehagen Douglas. San Diego had supported him in 1966. They had the committee. They set up a committee to elect the president 2 years before Nixon actually declared his candidacy in 1968. He had a lot of friends and backers here in San Diego, C. Arnold Smith being the chief one, who was a big fundraiser for him. And San Diego, they were looking for a place to have a convention, and a lot of the places, San Diego never put in an original bid because they didn't have the 18,000-room requirement, but they didn't like the various other cities for various reasons, and I don't really have time to go into it here. So they ended up coming to San Diego with their campaign officials, and they chose San Diego to 12,000, they overrode some of their objections, and they ended up choosing it. But one of the problems San Diego had was they didn't have enough money. And one of the representatives here, Representative Wilson, went to an ITT Sheraton meeting, annual meeting, and talked to Harold Janine, who was the CEO of ITT, and said, well, we don't have enough, we need $800,000, we don't have enough. And Janine said, well, if I give you $400,000, could you make up the other $400,000? Well, this excited Wilson, and San Diego decided that they could do this. Well, it happens at the same time in Washington, as you were saying, the government had filed a case against ITT to purchase Hartford Fire Insurance Company. And
this was the Nixon administration. He'd already been elected. This was a Republican administration, which was filing an antitrust investigation against ITT.
Right. And ITT had requested a meeting with then-Attorney General Kleindienst to talk about the problems that were going to happen if their financial problems if they weren't allowed to buy Hartford Fire Insurance Company. So they ended up reaching an agreement, and San Diego got the convention, and there was a lot of press about, was there a trade-off here that ITT was allowed to acquire Hartford Insurance on a deal outside of the courts in return for this donation of money to the Republican National to help support the San Diego Convention.
Now, there was also a question of the Attorney General at the time, the nominee for Attorney General, Richard Kleindienst. Hearings were being held into his confirmation in Washington, and that's where all this, as I recall, began to come out. These public hearings where Teddy Kennedy was, for the Democrats who chaired that committee at the time, I believe, was trying to bring out the fact that there'd been a quid pro quo here, that the $400,000 was donated clearly to the Republican Party to try to buy off the Justice Department.
Yeah. Kleindienst was at that time going through hearings to become the Attorney General. And Teddy Kennedy, he denied knowing anything about this, and Kennedy had brought in information that Kleindienst indeed had known about this deal some 2 months earlier, and they went back and forth on it, and eventually the whole ITT thing was blowing up, and the Republicans decided that they were just going to let this, they didn't want to have the convention here, and they ended up taking it to Miami. Of course, they said the problem was they were having too many cost overruns, the sports arena wasn't ready in time and whatnot, but a lot of people believe.
You also wrote about something else, which I want to get to while we still have time, that was going on here in San Diego, which was that there was then, and who knows, maybe still is now, a very active right-wing movement in the region. There was a group of far-right individuals who, if the convention had come here, planned to stage agent provocateur activities, trying to disrupt the convention, perhaps even going so far as to try to assassinate Richard Nixon, certainly going so far as to try to disrupt the protests. And we have to remember, this is not 1996, where the protesters are confined in a little pen, and if they have 200 or 300 people, they think it's a lot. Mm-hmm. We're talking about thousands, tens of thousands of people who wanted to march on the Republican convention that year, eventually did march on it in Miami, to protest, among other things, the Vietnam War. And this right-wing organization, it later emerged, in San Diego had some plans for those demonstrators when they came here. What did they want to do to us?
Well, it turns out that this group was called the Secret Army Organization. It grew out of a Minuteman when they were broken up in 1968. And it's very interesting when they finally busted this group, which had been attacking some local press here and had threatened and actually shot into the house of a San Diego professor of economics and actually blew up the Guild Theater here. And that's what finally got the police on them, and they finally shut them down. Well, one of the and when they had the trial, then they took the person to trial who had blown up this building. He turned out to be an FBI undercover agent who had been working undercover for the secret for the Minutemen, and then actually when that broke down, he went in. He actually formed the Secret Army organization and came to San Diego, and he had various plans, like they wanted to put LSD, cyanide, and strychnine in the anti-war. They were all anti-war protesters. They were all located on a little island here called Fiesta Island. He wanted to actually drop bombs on these people. He wanted to bomb various buildings, homes, and vehicles. He wanted to kidnap and assassinate anti-war vehicles. And he even got to the point he was looking to find a drone plane that was be full of explosives that he could drop on the demonstrators. And he even wanted to, he was even talking about ramming into Air Force One as President Nixon landed here in San Diego.
Now, when were these guys caught, and when was this particular guy caught?
Well, the Guild Theater, when it blew up, was in June of 72, so this trial went on a little bit after that, in the summer of 1972.
Pacifica Radio enters this story in a big way because a man named Lewis Tackwood gave a series of interviews to Pacifica station KPFK in Los Angeles, which were played on the air and turned out to be quite sensational. And those tapes of those interviews were subpoenaed and were the subject of a lot of struggle in court cases later on. Who was Lewis Tackwood? What did he have a role in this 1972 San Diego affair?
Well, Lewis Tackwood was a member of the L.A. Police Department. He was a part of the criminal conspiracy section, and his job was to watch left-wing groups, to be an infiltrator, an agent provocateur. And their idea was to come to San Diego and disrupt the convention in order to blame the left, smear the Democrats, maybe elect conservative Republicans, or even declare martial law. And he really wanted to turn San Diego into a bloodbath. And I know KPFK and some other papers were involved in this. And to get credibility, they contacted three journalists from Newsweek, the LA Times, and the Washington Post to come and look into this guy's background, and then they grilled him for 7 hours to check if there was any contradictions. He passed their test. Their paper still wouldn't run it, so they wanted him to take a lie detector test, which he agreed to do. He went before a well-known polygrapher, Chris Gugas, in Hollywood. He passed the lie detector test, and basically he told the story, which actually was similar to what came out of this secret army organization, that they wanted to seal off and bomb demonstrators, 100,000 of them at a rock concert, bomb the convention center, put explosives into hollow furniture. They even talked about blowing up the podium when Nixon was giving his acceptance speech.
Some of our younger listeners may find all of this incredible. I find it frighteningly real because I lived through all of this. There was an FBI action going on at the time known as COINTELPRO, whose very reason for being was to infiltrate and disrupt the left, whether it was the Black Panther Party, the anti-war movement. They created fake chapters, for example, a fake chapter of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War in North Florida in order to march on the Democratic Convention in Miami and then disrupt the protest with their own Vietnam Veterans Against the War chapter, which consisted entirely of FBI agents and agents provocateurs. I know when I tell this to young people who didn't live through that era or weren't aware what was going on, they find all of this incredible. But in your researches, you found it to be true.
Oh, yeah, it came out to be true. I mean, this story was, at least about Tackwood, was running the L.A. Times, the Washington Post.
Well, that doesn't mean it's true. They run lies all the time.
Well, they don't usually cover these kinds of stories,
no,
though.
No, they don't.
So it does add a little bit of credibility to it.
You know, I was watching Inside Politics on CNN about just a few weeks ago. They were talking about the lead-up to this convention, and they did go back to 1972, but they didn't, of course, talk about this. What they said is they showed a picture of the ITT building, and they said that in 1972, the whole approach toward campaign contributions was different. IT&T actually made a legal $400,000 contribution, but because people weren't used to that kind of thing at the time, they were forced to give it back, and the convention was moved from San Diego. The kind of story you're telling, no, was not told on CNN.
And they certainly didn't talk about the overthrow of Salvador Allende and the Dita Beard, lobbyist for ITT, who eventually was convicted of crimes associated with this.
Yeah. Yeah, actually the famous Dita Beard memo that Jack Anderson published in the Washington Post was really the thing that blew this whole ITT thing open. She claimed that this memo was a forgery, but basically laid out the whole deal, and at the end of it, you know, she was telling everybody, let's be quiet about this, pretend it's not going on, we'll
now,
ruin the deal.
What was Nixon saying at the time? I mean, he loved San Diego. It was the first committee to elect President Nixon that was formed in 1966 before he'd even announced. What was he saying when all of this was happening?
I don't know. I'm not sure what Nixon was saying at the time. I think he was, and it's not even clear what this, if this whole thing was aimed to help Nixon or to take out Nixon, because a lot of the right wing was pretty angry at Nixon.
That's right.
Because of his rapprochement with China and the Soviet Union. I think E. Howard Hunt, who used to be his PR person, said that we shouldn't be sending. We shouldn't be sending people to China. We should be sending bombs to China. So there was a violent, and this secret organization was very upset with Nixon. They thought the whole communists were influencing the government, infiltrating, and everything like that.
Bruce, let's fast forward to 1996 now. Here we are in San Diego, a rather different community in 1996 from it was in 1972. What's going on here now with the financing of this convention? It seems like I pick up the right-wing newspaper, daily newspaper here, and even they are outraged about the fact that the city is having to come up with more and more money pretty much every day to pay for these Republicans being here.
Couldn't they have helped them out? I mean, the San Diego Union-Tribune just spent $2 million on a media party.
What's going on here as far as the financing of this convention is going?
Well, I think, you know, just as in any convention, it seems like there's always cost overruns. They're never really prepared for how much they're going to pay. It always ends up costing more. San Diego, in some ways, I guess, is not really ready for a convention. It certainly wasn't in 72, and here in 96, the costs, it's just continuing to mount.
How about the corruption of who's paying for it? Do you think that exists this way, in the same way as ITT and other companies in 1972? Or will it take us 24 years to find out?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say. I haven't read too much about exactly the financing of this convention here, but
well, tomorrow on Democracy Now, we're going to be taking a look at tobacco interests and the money behind this campaign. Philip Morris, one of the largest contributors to the Republican Party, and of course, cigarette companies also do contribute to the Democratic Party. There were protests yesterday in the protest pen, protesting the fact that Philip Morris was sponsoring the Georgia delegation's party last night, and it was happening at the Museum of Art, and they felt that was their property, public property, and shouldn't be bought by a corporation.
Bruce,
I want to thank Bruce.
Let me just ask before we thank him and send him away, how can people get copies of these articles? I think there are people out there who may actually want to know some more about this. Can they call you up at the San Diego Review?
Yeah, they could contact me at the San Diego Review.
Phone number?
I don't have the phone number.
Okay.
Well,
area,
look it up.
I think it's area code 619-229.
Well, let's not guess.
Let's not speculate. They can look it up in information.
I feel sorry for that poor soul whose number that is. San Diego Review here in San Diego. And I want to thank Bruce McCraw for joining us and also for writing these pieces. And also thank the Alternative Media Center, who's put together a whole alternative media approach to the convention and bringing people speakers all day, every day, that you're not hearing on the platform of the GOP National Convention. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. It is engineered by Michael Yoshida. We want to thank Kathy Still, as well as all the people here at Pacifica who are making this program possible. We want to thank Ioka, as well as Bill Wax, and we want to thank Larry Bensky and Juan Gonzalez for joining us for this program. I'm Amy Goodman. Join us tomorrow for another edition of Democracy Now!